I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. USA Today is calling this political Groundhog Day. Seven more weeks of campaigning for Democrats. Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama back on the trail up to Pennsylvania's April primary and maybe beyond. Senator John McCain is now the Republican nominee in waiting. After yesterday's races in four states, he's lunching at the White House today. Last night, McCain spoke of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and said he would stand by the decision to invade Iraq.
It is of little use for Americans for their candidates to avoid the many complex challenges of these struggles by relitigating decisions of the past. I will defend the decision to destroy Saddam Hussein's regime as I...
Well, while the Republicans prep for the general election, the Democrats still duking it out for the remaining primaries and pledged delegates, but also for those freelance superdelegates. And on the CBS Early Show this morning, Senator Clinton hinted at a Clinton-Obama ticket. Here's Harry Smith questioning her.
We talked to a lot of people in Ohio who said there really isn't that significant a difference between you two, and they'd like to see you both on the ticket.
Well, that may, be where this is headed. But, of course, we have to decide who's on the top of the ticket. And I think that the people of Ohio very clearly said that it should be me.
Clinton and Obama also appeared on NBC's Today show this morning. Senator Clinton reiterated her position that experience matters and that only she and McCain have it. Obama responded.
If she thinks that longevity in Washington is the primary criteria for winning the White House, then John McCain is going to beat her.
It's just some of what's being said today by candidates who apparently never sleep. Well, today we're going to touch down with all the remaining campaigns. And later, Carl Bernstein will be here to share some thoughts about Hillary Clinton, seen today as both the comeback kid and by some, the party spoiler. But we start with the Clinton campaign. Amy Chozick has been following it for the Wall Street Journal. Amy, we just want to touch on Senator Clinton's hint today at the possibility of a joint ticket with Barack Obama. What more do we know about that?
Right. Well, that's not something so new. She's hinted at that at debates as well. And I think I'm not sure how much of that is going to be reality or how much of it is for party unity. But it certainly, you know, resonates well with voters to hear her saying that, I think.
Well, and Clinton in particular is, of course, her backers are ecstatic today. But other members of the party are seeing her as a divisive figure, someone who's extending the campaign. How is the campaign reacting to that?
Right. Well, the campaign has established its argument that she is the candidate who has won these big swing states, and they're going to be taking that argument to the superdelegates. She won't be catching up on delegates, but the campaign can say, look, she's won California, she's won Ohio, she's won Texas. So they have a case to make now, I think.
You mentioned the superdelegates, and Hillary Clinton said again on the Today Show that she believes that they can be wooed, these party officials, that they don't have to vote with the voters in their state. And a survey of voters as they left polling places in Texas and Ohio showed that more than 6 in 10 say the superdelegates should vote based on the results of their state's primaries and caucuses, but they can change their minds if they wish. So voters sort of seem to be edging towards Clinton's view of the superdelegates, but is this dangerous territory for her if she's seen as stealing them from Barack Obama?
Know about stealing. It is the role of the superdelegates to decide who they think would be the best candidate to battle the Republicans in November, and they can use their kind of knowledge of politics, the Democratic Party, to choose someone other than their constituents elect. Again, whether or not they'll want to go against the popular vote in their state is another question, and we have seen a lot of superdelegates, well, a few high-level superdelegates go over to Senator Obama for that reason.
What about the rest of the Clinton strategy going forward? Obviously, wooing superdelegates will be high on the list, but some analysts are saying that it was the end of the writer's strike that, helped her comeback because Saturday Night Live did that devastating skit accusing the press of not being tough enough on Barack Obama. And, of course, Hillary Clinton also had that 3 a.m. ringing phone ad attacking Barack Obama for not having experience on security. If analysts are attributing these events in the last week to her turnaround, does that give us some insight into how the campaign might go forward?
Absolutely. I think that we're going to see them continuing to paint her as the strong commander-in-chief, as the candidate who is strong on national security. But you made a good point when you mentioned Saturday Night Live, because I think that's also part of the campaign. She was a little vulnerable when she showed up on the show. She kind of poked some fun at herself, and I think that played well with voters as well.
Amy, one last question. There had been reports of a lot of division within the Hillary Clinton campaign, internal fighting. How does the campaign feel to you after last night?
You know, we've only been with them on the plane back from Columbus, but everybody seemed happy. I think that there are internal divisions, and there will continue to be because it's a really stressful campaign. There's a division between painting her as the strong commander-in-chief and then the softer side, and we've seen that ever since Iowa. So I think we'll continue to see that.
Yeah, but there's got to be a renewed spirit.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, they can use this as momentum going forward for fundraising. And basically, I think that, you know, as Bill Clinton said, if she wins, Ohio and Texas will go on to the convention.
Wall Street Journal reporter Amy Chozick with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Clinton backers have been saying the last week that voters have had buyer's remorse, that they've come back to her from Barack Obama. Let's turn now to Newsweek senior White House correspondent Richard Wolff, who's been covering Barack Obama on the campaign trail. In fact, I think he's just gotten off the plane. Richard, first of all, what's happening in Obama's campaign today?
Well, I think they're regrouping and trying to figure out what went wrong and how to fix it and how to get back on track. They have a game plan over the next few days involving, first of all, the next races in Wyoming and Mississippi, which they're pretty confident about. Hillary Clinton, mathematically impossible to overtake pledged delegate lead. So they're going to be focusing on that, but in the very short term, I think they're basically regrouping.
You say that they feel that they have the pledged delegates and it's virtually impossible for Clinton to pass them, and that she said she'll go after the superdelegates. Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe, has been talking about the cold, hard reality of that math, that she can't pass them in pledged delegates. But we're wondering, cold, hard reality, that doesn't sound like the Obama camp language of hope. Are you hearing, you know, a shift also in the tone of the campaign from the Obama camp, maybe toughening up after last week's attack from the Clinton campaign?
There's no doubt that there's going to be a harder edge to the Obama campaign now. They've been holding back, making a lot of criticisms and attacks on the Clinton folks. And that's really going to be forthcoming now over the next days and weeks. But in terms of the delegate count, I mean, it is a question of numbers and also a basic principle which they're really counting on, and that's superdelegates, party insiders, should not and in all likelihood would not overturn delegates apportioned by real voters. In other words, you have the will of the voters against party insiders.
Right.
And the Obama campaign are basically relying on the party insiders to say that they're not going to overturn what the voters want.
And the Clinton campaign is saying, and she said this morning on the Today Show, that in fact that's what superdelegates are for, that there's information in the campaign now that wasn't there, you know, a couple months ago when there were primaries. And so these superdelegates are the ones who take in the latest information as opposed to, you know, having to just go with their party vote. And Obama's response, by the way, was, well, that's not working very well for you because the superdelegates have been coming over to him in the past couple of weeks. But how is the Obama campaign responding to the analysis that maybe Saturday Night Live was right, that the media hadn't scrutinized him as much? The Project for Excellence in Journalism tracked the media last week and found that he was, after that accusation, covered a lot more.
Well, I think they were covered a lot more aggressively because the Clinton campaign was pushing critical stories very hard, and the media was taking it on and reporting on that. And the Obama campaign did a very bad job of stopping those stories and fighting back. And the truth is that he's been getting a lot more positive coverage because he's been winning a lot more races. And when you win 11 races in a row, you get better news stories out there, just like Hillary Clinton's getting better news stories today. It's not because the press has suddenly changed its whole psyche. It's because winners get more favorable coverage. So that's something to really bear in mind here. And look, the idea that the Clintons have been fully vetted when we really haven't dug around in their finances, we haven't been able to see their finances, those kinds of issues are really yet to be played out. You know, the media will do its job, but I suspect the days when the Clinton campaign can sort of play the rest, blame the media for the situation, those days have come to an end.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, on the Barack Obama campaign trail. In fact, just stepping off an airplane. So, Richard, we thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Senator John McCain is with George Bush today. Holly Bailey of Newsweek has been covering McCain's campaign. And Holly, you know, McCain and the president had a difficult past. There was the ugly 2000 campaign, the fight over torture, and of course, Bush is a symbol of the war in Iraq. So was there any question in the McCain campaign about possibly not going to the White House?
Not at all. You know, on one hand, there has been a difficult relationship between the president and McCain. You know, they have referenced all their troubles back in 2000. But the fact is that President Bush, despite his low poll numbers, is still pretty popular with the Republican base. And so, therefore, John McCain needs him, especially as John McCain sort of tries to unite the party behind his general election nomination.
Well, there were those comments from Clinton and Obama on the Today Show today. She said that she and McCain had experience. Obama shot back, well, I'd be happy to align you with his experience because it's the Bush-Cheney war in Iraq experience. Is that particularly dangerous for McCain? Last night, he said he pledged to defend the decision to topple Saddam Hussein.
It is dangerous for McCain because he has depended so much on support from independents and moderates. So that's the question going into the general election is how much is he going to sort of embrace, you know, Republican principles and President Bush and his record? Is he going to risk alienating the people who have sort of gotten him to where he is?
Well, exit polls last night showed that conservative voters in Texas and Ohio still sided with Huckabee. So he has many challenges going ahead. What's his strategy?
His strategy is basically, you know, he's getting the endorsement of President Bush today. He's going also to the RNC to sort of start building up the campaign operation there. But he's going to be rolling out more endorsements from top conservative leaders. You know, he's sort of all through Texas, he campaigned with Phil Gramm, who is a hero to the right. He's also, you know, appeared with John Hagee, the pastor here in Texas, which is a somewhat controversial endorsement. But, you know, that, you know, John Hagee is very popular among, you know, evangelicals. So you're going to continue to see a lot of those endorsements roll out from the McCain campaign, and he's really going to start focusing more on uniting the party. You keep hearing the language that he's here to unite the party, and I think that's what you're going to continue to hear for several months now on.
Well, you might not hear it, though, because if the Democrats continue to battle, they're going to take the headlines. If John McCain is sort of knocked out of the headlines, does he then get sort of knocked out of the race in a way? Is there maybe a downside to his having wrapped up this nomination so soon?
Not really. I mean, you know, on one hand, you know, the open secret from the McCain campaign is that they wanted the Democratic fight to continue going on, even if it means that John McCain is on the front page of the newspapers every day. Because you have to remember, John McCain sort of is at that point to where he's rebuilding his campaign. He's coming back from a near collapse, doesn't have a lot of money, so he wants to spend a lot of downtime raising money, sort of building his infrastructure. And, you know, as long as the fight continues on the Democratic side, that's good for the McCain campaign, they feel.
And when do you think we might hear about a running mate?
That's obviously been a big topic on the McCain plane. Charlie Black, who is McCain's top strategist, basically told us yesterday that they're not in any hurry to roll that out, that they're going to do a traditional timeline, roll it out maybe a few weeks before the convention. They see no urgency in announcing a running mate at this point.
Holly Bailey of Newsweek on the McCain campaign trail. Holly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, listener Keith Hood has written us an email to ask how much were yesterday's primary victories by Hillary Clinton about race and the voters, especially in Ohio. We're going to cover that in a future show. But meanwhile, how much will race be a factor between the two Democratic candidates? We're going to explain with author Carl Bernstein. Later, is Venezuela really at war with Colombia, as Venezuela's justice minister claims? That's later in the program. We'll be back in 1 minute here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, the story today is Hillary Clinton's comeback, her second in the campaign. Her supporters see her as heroic, her detractors in the party as divisive. Carl Bernstein is a veteran journalist and author of the best-selling biography, A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's just out in paperback. And Carl, we want to look ahead with you first as a biographer. But before that, Clinton's people would say they finally, in the last couple of weeks, did what only Saturday Night Live, not the press, would do. What do you think happened here? How do you think she pulled this off?
A negative campaign worked for her. You need to look at the campaign in the context of her life. I spent 7 years, you know, working on this biography, and what we've seen in the past few weeks goes both to the best of Hillary Clinton, as well as to those aspects of her that some of her aides and associates find disturbing and always have.
Well, what do we know about her past? You alluded to it. That helps us understand how she goes forward now.
it's really necessary to understand her life. You know, here she is, the best-known woman in the world, and yet she correctly says, people really don't know who I am. And you see a pattern in her life. Her father was a sour, unfulfilled man, a martinet who verbally abused and diminished her mother. The theme of fear of shame, fear of humiliation in her life, without this being a psychobiography, repeats itself again and again. Whitewater. What was Whitewater really all about? It wasn't about anything criminal. It was about partly an out-of-control special prosecutor. The Clintons were absolutely right about that. But at bottom, it was about her own fear of embarrassment, that her lawyering back in Arkansas would be shown to have some small-time conflicts of interest rather than looking like some, you know, great pro bono law practice concerned with great issues of civil liberties.
The thing you write was a real stumbling block for both of them initially. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a little bit from your newly released paperback, which has been updated. You write, "The shining aspect of the Clintons' politics has always been their private understanding of the tragedy of race in America. Each has spoken eloquently, publicly and privately, of the day when a black candidate for president would capture the imagination of the country and be elected, but never did they anticipate that it might happen on Hillary's watch and in opposition to them." How do they handle that going forward when, as we just heard from the campaign, they're going to have to continue attacking Obama to fight it out?
Well, you know, it'll be a combination of negative and a combination of what her message is, which is an economic message. And at the same time, she uses terms like NAFTAgate.
Well, that brings us back to the Obama campaign and that question of, you know, is there a point when you see, and again, it's speculation, but that Hillary Clinton might realize that she, of all people, a civil rights activist, is seen as not just attacking the potential first black president, but being divisive to the party, and that she does quit?
Well, first of all, I think she has by winning last night in both Texas and Ohio, she has got a pretty good argument to make that she shouldn't quit. The math doesn't work. She can't win a majority of the delegates unless she gets the superdelegates. I think that but right now she's had a couple of significant victories that we'll be seeing some interesting campaigning in Pennsylvania, but the prospects of her quitting right now are next to nil. And what she must do, if she is going to prevail in this, however, is to somehow, she cannot possibly get a majority of delegates unless the math just doesn't work. Even if she wins every primary, she'd have to win it by 15-20% from here on in, and she still couldn't get up to Obama and pledge delegates, probably. So it would mean it would have to go to the superdelegates. But if there was enough momentum going her way, it's certainly conceivable that some of those superdelegates who were leaning to Obama might have second thoughts about it. Back to your question about race, which has been, in case of Bill and Hillary Clinton's, the most admirable aspect of their adult lives, has been their understanding of the tragedy and race in America. And you know, this has been their worst nightmare. To, as Bill Clinton said, all my life I've been waiting to vote for a woman for president. All my life I've been waiting to vote for an African American for president. And I believe his words were, God, why at the same time? I'm paraphrasing a little bit there. And really, I think what he means is, more, why on our watch?
Yeah.
And it's a terrible dilemma. And yes, they did play the race card, such as it was, and that has really alienated a lot of Democrats. And it seems to me that the best thing that we can do in terms of learning about this campaign is to learn about who Hillary Clinton is. And she's a fascinating, compelling woman with a great story. And believe it or not, we know very little about it because so much of it has been promulgated by misinformation and disinformation by her opponents and enemies on the one hand and by her acolytes and true believers on the other. And I think if people do take the time to look at her real life, they'd be fascinated at how different it is from the caricatures.
Carl Bernstein, author of A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's now out in paperback. Carl, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's review here. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, as we said, are watching the delegate and superdelegate count closely. In the overall race for the nomination, Obama has 1,562 delegates, including superdelegates. Clinton has 1,461, the magic number, 2,025 to secure the nomination. She would need to win 60% of the pledged delegates in upcoming primaries to do that. Most analysts agree with Carl Bernstein. She'd have to win the superdelegates as well. And then there's Michigan and Florida. Senator Clinton is again calling for Florida and Michigan to be counted in the nomination race. The governor of Florida has said he would consider holding another primary. Stay tuned. It will continue. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the politics of poverty. Why aren't we hearing more about that? That's tomorrow. Be back after the news, Here and Now. Do communist guerrillas fighting to overthrow the pro-American government in Colombia want to build a dirty bomb? And is Hugo Chavez, the anti-American president of neighboring Venezuela, helping them by giving them $300 million? These are two big questions that remain unanswered today after several days of saber-rattling sparked by Colombia's raid into a third country, Ecuador, last Saturday, to kill a top guerrilla leader. Two laptops were found in that raid. Colombian leaders say documents on those computers show that the FARC rebels were thinking about buying uranium and that Chavez and Venezuela funded them. Venezuela denies this and has massed troops on the Colombian border. And the Venezuelan Justice Minister has declared that war has already begun. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Adam Isaacson, senior associate at the Center for International Policy, which tracks U.S. military involvement in Latin America. And Adam, first of all, is it your sense that war is underway in Latin America?
I don't think that war is underway, actually. I think that at this point, this crisis is moving more into the diplomatic phase. All the other big countries in Latin America are pushing Venezuela, Ecuador, and Colombia to the table and through the OAS. And you know, there's always a chance that there could be some flare-up at the border that spins out of control, but I really don't think war is in the offing.
Well, you've read some of the documents now posted online from these laptops that Colombia says that it found after the raid into Ecuador. You've written that they don't exactly clarify things, so but what do they tell you?
Well, the first one about there's a lot in there, but the first about the uranium, there's a paragraph in a message written by one of the most radical militaristic members of the FARC talking about some conversations, not with Venezuelans, with somebody we don't know, to try to get 50 kilograms of uranium to build a dirty bomb. Whether this was, you know, the FARC's something the FARC was really actively pursuing, or whether it was just a pet project of this one member of the group, we don't know, but it is very serious. The other allegation, and it pops up a few times, there's a few references starting end of December, early January, to what the FARC were calling a dossier, which was their code name for some arrangement to get some money from the Venezuelans, perhaps in the form of petroleum or gasoline that they could sell and take, you know, launder the profits through front companies. It's not at all clear. It's not clear, you know, whether any of this ever materialized, whether this was wishful thinking on the part of the FARC people writing the documents. Whether Hugo Chavez himself had anything to do with it.
Is it clear, by the way, that it's truly from the laptop, or could it have been planted there?
Well, you can't dismiss that, but we'll never have any way of knowing whether this was planted there. It's certainly, you know, the Colombian military, though, is awfully busy with its own civil war against the FARC and other, another smaller guerrilla group. I don't know why they would want to plant something there to open up a new front in their war with Venezuela.
Mm. Well, Chavez, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, has actively been aiding in getting hostages released from the FARC rebels, getting a lot of publicity for that. But why is he so supportive of them? They have waged a bloody campaign for decades. They're hated in Colombia.
That's right.
Is this possibly backfiring on him in his own country?
It doesn't make sense. You know, even looking at the documents that they put out from those laptops, it's clear that even as recently as last fall, Chavez and the FARC, they had contacts, but they didn't really know each other very well. That changed over the course of the fall when President Uribe surprisingly made Chavez sort of a mediator for talks to get these hostages out. Uribe then fired Chavez in November because he didn't like the way he was doing it, and things flew out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in January, Chavez started talking very kindly of the FARC. But you're right, it makes no sense if your project, and as Chavez is, to make all of Latin America leftist, the FARC are not your advocates. They're hugely unpopular in Colombia, and they're also weaker militarily than they were several years ago.
Right, and the this past weekend's incursion was by Colombia into Ecuador, you know, another country entirely. So why would he inject himself into that? Why is all of this happening, do you think?
Well, he would inject himself into it because the president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, is an ally of Chavez's. He's another left-of-center leader who's quite critical of U.S. policy in the region and who had been doing his own, carrying out his own political dialogues with the FARC, too. Now, and Venezuela had been in the process, especially since January when Chavez started talking kindly of the FARC, of really talking to them all the time. So Chavez actually declared a moment of silence for the dead guerrilla leader on Sunday in a national televised address and basically said, if you do something like that to us, Colombia, it will be war and we'll send our Russian fighter planes to get you. And so I'm going to send troops to the border to prevent that from happening.
Could part of this war of words on Chavez's part be about his waning popularity?
A lot of it could be an effort to distract and to try to whip up nationalist sentiment, at least, and particularly to energize his own base, probably though about one-third of Venezuelans who will be with Chavez, right or wrong, no matter what happens. And yeah, Venezuela has the highest inflation in the whole region, food shortages because of price controls, crime is spiraling out of control. And so, yeah, he does have a lot that he would want to distract people from. His popularity ratings, as far as we can tell, are probably well under 50% at this point.
Right. Well, and there are a couple other things hanging in the balance here. There's the free trade agreement that President Bush wants Congress to approve with Colombia.
Right.
But there's also the fate of the hostages the rebels were negotiating to release. They include three American contractors, Ingrid Betancourt, the former Colombian senator and presidential candidate.
That's right.
You know, the president of France has said, I will go get her. How is this war of words affecting their situation?
It delays for weeks or months or maybe even years the day that we'll see them be free. Chavez, through his contacts with the FARC and his increasingly friendly talk to the FARC, was actually convincing the FARC to let go some of these hostages unilaterally. They've actually freed six of the civilians they were holding, and there are only seven civilians that they are still holding to pressure for a prisoner exchange. That said, that process is going to be on hold now for a while, as long as this happens. And also, the rebel leader who was killed on Saturday, he wasn't a great guy, but he was the FARC's main channel of contact to the outside world. He was the one the French government, for instance, was talking to about Ingrid Betancourt. So things are, you're really back to square one on a lot of things having to do with getting the hostage spree.
And just briefly, the U.S. has spent $5 billion in Colombia to fight drugs and rebels, and the rebels are the ones marketing the drugs. Just very briefly, why isn't it working?
Well, the drug war has failed, really, because supply and demand. The demand remains constant in the world. The profits are astronomical. Colombia is a huge country the size of Texas and California with, tens of millions of acres you can still cut down to grow coca without anybody ever catching you. We've done very little to help Colombia actually govern their country in a way that would give economic opportunity to people who are so poor that coca actually seems like an option.
Yeah. So people partaking in America, for instance, are fueling the fighting that we're reading about in that region. Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Quick note about a story that we're working on. Rethinking saving endangered areas like the Everglades. Sea levels rise due to climate change. People are asking, what is worth saving? That's in an upcoming show. You're listening to Here and Now.
We'll be right back.
There are plenty of community newsletters where family and friends exchange recipes. Well, now Mom's Best Meal can be the star in a national magazine. Actually, Mom's Best Meal is the name of a feature in Taste of Home, maybe the most popular food magazine you've never heard of. Every 2 months, Taste of Home gives their 3 million readers tips and recipes, family stories, and solicits additional contributions. Joining us with more is Catherine Cassidy. She's Taste of Home's editor-in-chief and joins us from Milwaukee Public Radio. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us on the line from her home in Broomfield, Colorado, is Krista Smith Klebenstein. She's a reader who sent in her mother's recipes. Krista, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
And Catherine, I want to start with you. How do you differ from, let's say, the church magazine that goes out or, you know, the books that towns put together of people's recipes?
The big difference is that all of these recipes do come in from readers, but they are tested. I have a test kitchen staff of about 20. We also have a really wonderful photo studio in-house, and I love saying this about Taste of Home, that every single recipe does carry a photograph. I know when I'm cooking, I am so much more likely to actually make something if I can see the way it's going to turn out.
Well, speaking of the testing, you sent to us the super chunky cookie contribution from Rebecca Gendry of Spring Branch, Texas. This was whipped up in your test kitchens, and we felt obligated to taste the cookie to see what was special about it. It's amazing. It's so good, and it's like a brick. It's so big. What's in the, I mean, so many people have chocolate chip cookie recipes. What was it about this cookie that got it into the magazine?
Well, that one in particular, we call that the captain of the chocolate chip cookie team. There's like five different types of chips in there. I think milk, dark, semi-sweet, there's chocolate chunk, there's toffee chips. And I think that's an interesting point, that there are hundreds of chocolate chip cookie recipes. I do credit my test kitchen team. They have a knack for being able to eyeball recipes and say, that looks very interesting.
Well, they need to have a knack, because how many submissions do you get a year?
It's been in the neighborhood of 80 to 90,000.
I mean, that's amazing. Do you cook all of them?
No. Of all of those submissions, we're probably publishing about 8,000 a year. And I would say that of the 7,500, we're probably testing 10,000. Before they ever get into the kitchen, they're looking at it. They're looking for something special, something unique.
Well, on the Taste of Home. And that brings us to Krista, who was one of the people whose recipes caught your eye. And Krista, your contribution came under the, you know, My Mom's Best Meal. You write beautifully about how much your mother cooked.
Absolutely. She cooked every day for a family of five, and the recipe that I submitted was one of my all-time favorite recipes. I grew up in Wisconsin, and when she started making the silver-plated pot roast, that meant summer was here. I love that you can just put it on the grill and socialize and spend time with your family and friends.
And then to go along with that, the sour cream potatoes, the coconut pineapple cake, the berry salad. Come on. Does she really cook like this every day?
She cooked like that very, very often. As I mentioned in the article, one time I found a list of things that she was going to do for a holiday, and it was over a dozen different types of cookies and like seven side dishes and a main dish, and cooking was really her passion, and I have kept some of her recipes.
It seems, Catherine, that that's really what is so powerful about this magazine. I found myself reading as much about Krista's relationship with her mom, Sherry, as I did, you know, looking at the recipes of what she actually cooked.
You're absolutely right. There will be a recipe in the magazine for, a particular cake. I can think of one right off the top of my head. It's the Candyland cake that was submitted from a woman in Berkeley, California.
I saw that. It's on the back of one of the issues I have. Look at that.
Yes. What you don't know and what you don't see is that we had hundreds of people make that cake and then take pictures of their children or of a family event where the cake was served. The recipes that are in this magazine, they represent a lot of love and caring and sharing. And I think that is really what makes Taste of Home unique.
That's Catherine Cassidy, editor-in-chief of Taste of Home magazine. We've also been speaking with Krista Smith Klebenstein from Broomfield, Colorado, who sent her mother's recipes to the magazine. If you want more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Catherine and Krista, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And in 1 minute, we'll be back with a late winter touch of frost here and now. Pa. poet Robert Frost is an American icon and something of a literary rock star, with greatest hits such as Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening and The Road Not Taken.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Or I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back.
Frost's words are measured, the delivery a bit dry. But Robert Frost had another side that we're about to hear for the first time in live recordings of lectures Frost gave at Dartmouth College back in the 1940s. Here Now's Andrea Shea has more on the release of Robert Frost, Unplugged.
Robert Frost's connection to Dartmouth College goes back a long way, all the way to 1892, the year the poet arrived in Hanover, New Hampshire as a freshman. But scholar James Sitar says Frost's initial run at the Ivy League school was a short one.
His grandparents thought that Harvard was too much of a drinking school, so they sent him up to Dartmouth. And he spent all of about 2 months there before dropping out.
Sitar says Frost, an iconoclast, wasn't well suited to the rigidity of higher education. But after achieving a measure of fame later in life, the Yankee poet returned to Dartmouth, where he received not one but two honorary doctorates. Sitar himself went to Dartmouth, and as a sophomore in 1999, he says he stumbled on an overlooked trove in the school's special collections library, audio recordings of lectures Frost gave at the school in the 1940s. You could call them the forgotten Frost bootlegs, more like talks, really, with seniors.
He didn't have any prepared notes for most of these lectures, not any that we know of, at least. And so he was mostly shooting from the hip. But it wasn't that he was merely saying anything that came to his mind. You get a sense that he's honed his thoughts and that these are the thoughts that he's sharing with these young students.
Frost's thoughts on everything from current events to bending the rules to punctuation to people's reactions to his own poetry.
Somebody will say to me, I understand your poem, but they want to know, what are you getting at? I think they mean, under what head does that come? Say, under what head? How does it classify? Is it pessimistic or optimistic or something like that? I can't find out. But I always say to them defensively, you know, if I'd wanted you to know, I'd told you in the poem.
Sitar says he had a hunch the tapes were unique, Frost on stage candidly addressing a room full of students. And for the past 9 years, Sitar has been transcribing, cataloging, and studying the tapes. The text of the lecture you just heard, titled Sometimes It Seems As If, has just been published in the current issue of Literary Imagination. Peter Campion edits the scholarly journal and says Frost is in his element here, revealing a Frost you can't get by reading his biographies, letters, or essays.
Here he is talking about how figurative language works. Here he is making a mild diss on Whitman, who was his beloved yet troublesome forebear in American letters. You know, here he is making mild diss on Ezra Pound. We're really going to have a lot more of a sense about Frost's imagination and intelligence that he brought to bear in his own poems from these recordings.
And the only way to get me is to go way back, you know, and come by poems, one after another. And it doesn't matter where you start. No poem is intelligible except in the light of all the other poems, all the poems that were ever written. So you better get about them, circulating among them. That's what I say in the spirit of poetry, too. And you take as much stock in it as I'm telling you to take.
For Literary Imagination editor Peter Campion, listening to this recording for the first time was a Frost groupie's dream come true.
It was like having a guitar hero walk into your living room with an acoustic guitar and sit down and, you know, start to give you off-the-cuff little lessons and play what he wanted to play. And here we have this icon of American literature unplugged.
It's a bit like seeing Bob Dylan at Newport when he was only 20, 21 years old, 22 years old.
Jay Perini is a poet and Frost biographer who teaches at Middlebury College in Vermont. He says while there are hundreds of tapes of Frost talking about his poems, these lectures provide a snapshot of the poet on the cusp of becoming an American icon.
What's interesting here is to see Frost in this immediate post-war moment, 1947, when Frost is combining a sense of his own experience, his own place in the world as it's evolving as poet and public persona, with the sense of the nation's accomplishment.
Frost was in his 60s when he delivered this lecture at Dartmouth, and Perini says the poet was developing an act that he would take on the road hundreds of times in the 50s and 60s.
He was a song and dance man, Robert Frost. He was out there on the stage. He was playing the role of Robert Frost. In many ways, it was a kind of a shtick. And reading this material, it's very familiar to anybody who knows Frost well. He's using some of the same old lines over and over and over again. And he was, in many ways, perfecting the mask of the rambling old Yankee farmer slash poet slash philosopher.
Frost wasn't even born in New England, Perini reminds us. He went on to become something of a Mount Rushmore figure 2 years later after this lecture at Dartmouth with the publication of his collected poems in 1949. A year later, Time magazine put the poet on its cover. And while the newly published lecture captures a particular point in the evolution of Frost's career, Perini says the recordings are golden.
I would think that readers will make very little out of the actual transcripts. I think the real treasure here is the tapes themselves.
Sometimes, for instance, I might, in taking up the first one, hear of a new one that I'll read slowly to you. It's not specially made, not as much made as a good many of mine for reading aloud, but I want to read it to you. It sometimes seems as if, back out of all this now, too much for us, back in a time made simple by the loss of detail.
That's Frost introducing Directive, a poem he wrote in 47, the same year he gave this lecture. Biographer Jay Perini says that while it's interesting to hear Frost on the hoof, making jokes and reacting to the audience, his rambling style might bore all but devout Frost fans. James Sitar, the guy who rediscovered the tapes at Dartmouth 9 years ago as a student, says listening to the Frost lectures today is still electrifying and makes him feel like a kid again.
When I take out a tape and I'm checking my transcription or I'm just listening to it on my iPod, there's that same sense that this iconic man is someone who was prone to making jokes, sometimes very unfunny jokes, but nevertheless that he was a very human figure in these recordings.
Somebody says, why, is poetry a way of saying one thing and meaning another? Yeah, kind of, you know.
Robert Frost speaking with students at Dartmouth College in 1947. To read his entire lecture, go to our website, here-now.org. Our story came from Here and Now's Andrea Shea with many, many thanks to the estate of Robert Frost for use of the recordings. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.